Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast of Connecting Faith. Programs like this are made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. You can find out more or make a gift by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab on the homepage. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for tuning in to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Hope you've had a great day so far. Looking forward to a good discussion ahead as we spend a little time reviewing a bit about our heritage and history. We're talking particularly about our faith heritage because it's tied into a Jewish history and tradition, and we're looking forward to bringing in a discussion talking about Jesus and the Jewish festivals. That is the title of the fourth book in a series called Ancient Context, Ancient Faith. And to do that, we're going to visit with a professor of theological studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School, and we'll introduce him in just a moment. But as long as we're talking about the Jewish festivals and learn a little bit about ancient culture and discover some hidden meanings, I want to focus on, as we've been doing regularly here on the program, and especially in Faith Radio Mornings, been talking about the opportunities to partner with World Vision in child sponsorship. So out of the stack of children's names and profiles that we have remaining, our goal over the course of these months has been to see 120 children sponsored, and we have 40 or so to go still. And so I would just encourage you, if you are someone who has been thinking about that and you've been prompted perhaps to respond, would you consider a Balsam? She's a young girl. In fact, she's a one-year-old girl, just born last February in Jerusalem, West Bank, Gaza. And she has one sister and one brother. Her parents struggle to provide for her family. Her father's a policeman. Despite their efforts, it's difficult to meet family needs. She's growing up in a urban community in the Israel-Palestine region, and it's a difficult childhood for her, you can well imagine. Or maybe we can't. That's more likely it. So I just want to just mention that the Balsam is one of the girls that are available for a child sponsorship, and your call today could truly change a life and offer hope in this needy situation. There's health needs that are concerned, there's dietary needs, there's education needs, there's many things, and through it, the love of God is presented in a very clear way. So if a one-year-old Balsam is interesting to you, beautiful young girl, you can call us right now at 877-933-2484. And find out about being a World Vision sponsor, or you can go to our website, faithradionet.com, and then click on the link there, the World Vision link. Thanks for doing that. Let's introduce our guest. Gary Burge is a professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Biblical Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School. He's authored a number of books, including Who Are God's People in the Middle East?, What Christians Are Not Being Told About Israel and the Palestinians?, also been involved in several application commentary series. The reference that we're going to spend some time on is the fourth in a series called Ancient Context, Ancient Faith. And those include books like The Bible and the Land, Jesus, the Middle Eastern Storyteller, Encounters with Jesus, and now Jesus and the Jewish Festivals. Gary, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks for making some time available today.
Great. Thanks, Neil. It's good to be with you.
I just mentioned before the broadcast that I know you get back to school soon, so this could be like a little warm up for you, and we'll
yep.
We'll be your class and see how your first year students are doing. But
exactly,
we've
got every campus in America right now. We've got, you know, it's really great to see the freshmen all come back. You know, it's the only week of the year we actually see them in wonderfully clean clothes, well pressed, beautifully attired, and then it's downhill from here to Thanksgiving.
so you you have a vision of what they could look like if they cleaned up. So yeah.
Oh, exactly. They're still their mom has still laundered all their clothes and it's all nice. But you ought to come see it in October.
Yeah. Well, Gary, maybe before we talk a little bit about some of the specifics of the book, I'm interested. Was this a passion of yours just to to spend time in the Holy Land just to understand more as a
sure.
as a professor, a Bible professor? Was that important to just kind of dig down below the surface?
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Well, it is a passion of mine, and I think my own story is kind of connected to books such as these. One of the real blessings that God has given to me over my life has been opportunities to be in the Middle East in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different contexts. So often you hear about people who lead trips to the Holy Land, and they may do it 12 times, but actually they've only been there once. They've, you know, done the same trip 12 times. One of the unusual things that I've been able to do is study there in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Iraq, Egypt, Libya. I've had opportunities to really go in depth into a lot of these cultures. And I've, you know, it's been over 30 times now, I think. And it's what came away from me, especially as a student, was recognizing that actually the Bible is a foreign book. It comes from a foreign culture. It has a universal message that is timeless. But of course, when God came into history in Jesus Christ, he had to use the culture that was there native to the people who were listening to Jesus. Well, the catch is that that culture of that audience is completely different than who we are today. So when Jesus tells a parable, for instance, about a sower who goes out to sow seed in the field, if you're from Iowa and you're thinking about farming and you're thinking about what it means to put seed in a field, it's completely different than what Jesus was talking about 2,000 years ago. So whenever we import our cultural assumptions from the 21st century into the biblical world of the first century of Jesus' life in the Gospels, we are always going to make mistakes. So we have to become, as it were, time travelers. We need to become cultural anthropologists so that we can actually hear these ancient stories through Middle Eastern ears. And so my exposure to this whole world of the Middle East has really brought me into a study of ancient Judaism and ancient, say, village life of that world. And frankly, I discover two things. Number one, I don't read the Gospels the same anymore. And secondly, when I'm explaining these differences to an audience in a church or at a conference today, oh my goodness, they love it. They're saying, why didn't anyone ever explain these things to me before? So I think this is a really great revelation, I think, for people who really love the Bible and want to understand Jesus' message with new clarity.
I guess, and maybe you've kind of already answered that, but you know, to look at this this study, if it's an essential study or if it's just sort of an added benefit, it's sort of like a, you know, a value-added service. So here's your biblical text, and here's a little value-added thing we can just throw in. Or is it really essential?
Well, you know, to a certain extent, I think it's essential that we have this kind of thing. I mean, it would be the equivalent, Neil, of perhaps going to an international film festival in, say, your hometown. And there you're watching a film that was maybe produced in France 20 years ago. Maybe by, here it is, the Muslim community on the outskirts of Paris in 1980. Let's try that. And here you are watching this film, and of course all of the language has been, you know, dubbed for you, or you can read, you know, script underneath the screen. And you get the general sort of thrust of the film. You understand it's a murder mystery, and you get all of that. But then after the film, you go out to a restaurant with some good friends who are from France, and they say to you, yeah, but did you understand that this was really what was going on behind the scenes? And all of these little messages, these codes which were in the story, were missed by the Western audience. And suddenly now you have someone explaining it to you, and you say to yourself, well, I understood about 30% of that movie, I think. But now I really see what was going on. Good storytelling always has things going on behind the scenes. And so therefore, I think, yeah, this has become an essential way for us to understand the Gospels. It really is. Take a very simple example, Neil. We talk about calling God Abba, Father. Jesus used Abba. And in church, that makes no sense to us in church, because the word Abba isn't in our vocabulary. It's not an English word. So right away, we have to have someone who's our teacher or preacher say to us, Jesus spoke Aramaic, this is an Aramaic word, and here is what it meant if you used it 2,000 years ago. So we are doing this anyway in church all of the time. I'm just taking it to the next step.
In a few minutes here, as we unpack the book, Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, we'll have Gary review some of those festivals, some things that we can learn how Jesus used those festivals to reveal himself. But maybe before we do that, just a word about maybe festivals in general. I mean, do we what do we mean by them, at least the festivals of Judaism? They're
right.
Public holidays, right?
Yeah, they are. They were very much public holidays. But I think that when we talk about public holidays, even that is a Western idea that comes out of our culture, because we think that we stop from work. The stores may be open, but the mail does not get delivered.
Yeah.
We have all kinds of assumptions with that. In Jesus' world, there is no secular and religious. Everything is integrated together. So religious life, political life, national life, all of these things come together. So at Passover, you have a national holiday, a religious holiday, and so you everything, all of life gets reinterpreted through this. And by the way, it requires things of you. If you're going to live as a part of that society 2,000 years ago, you are expected to do certain things. And in our world, I don't think we have anything like that. We really don't. Everything is voluntary. There is no comprehensive exercise. But festivals are a way that every culture marks time. And we mark the year and we pause and recognize not only what is happening during that year, perhaps an agricultural festival where we, Thanksgiving is our only agricultural festival, where we pause and say, thank you, God, because we have now the harvest. Or it might be a festival, maybe a time when we mark the memory of great historical events, a political campaign, a war, a freedom, something like that. Anyway, maybe after the break, what I can do is I can tell you about the way that Israel marked its calendar and how Jesus was aware of that and how Jesus took advantage of it.
Let's do that, and we'll return in about 60 seconds. We're talking today with Professor Gary Burge, who has written the fourth in a series of ancient context, ancient faith. This is from Zondervan. It's called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, and we will uncover the ancient culture and discover the hidden meanings of the festivals. We'll get to that in a moment, and you're always welcome to join the conversation as well. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. Gary Burge is a professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School. It's 18 past the hour. Glad to have you tuned in to Connecting Faith, and glad for the opportunity to do a little instruction today, or learning today. I always feel like if you've learned something here in Faith Radio, then it's been a good day, and today will be a great hour to learn more about Jesus and the Jewish festivals, that ancient culture and the context, the meanings that are behind these festivals that were so important to the Jewish culture and make such a difference in our understanding of the Scriptures. And to help us do that is Professor Gary Burge. Dr. Burge is a professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School. He's authored a number of books, the one we're referencing, Jesus and the Jewish Festivals. We're going to talk about, you know, why did Jesus break the Jewish Sabbath? How was the Passover lamb sacrificed? Some of those things. But Gary, let's maybe just review, talk a little bit about, you know, some examples of how Jesus used these festivals, or what we can learn about. I will give you a chance to practice your lecture for tomorrow's beginning class.
Well, the thing that I try to remind my students of initially, Neil, is that in order to understand a culture, you have to ask yourself, okay, so how is it that they see their larger festival calendar? And Jews, actually, in the first century, they had a festival going almost all year long. And so you just have to ask, well, what festival are we in? But there were three principal festivals which organized the Jewish year, and I can mention those to you in a moment. But I think the main festival I want to mention that we normally overlook is the Sabbath. Now, when you and I think about festivals, we think, well, they're annual, like Christmas comes every December. But actually, in Judaism, you have a festival which is a weekly festival, and Sabbath is probably the most important thing in Jewish identity in this time. In fact, the Roman Empire, when they thought about Jews, they said, you know, there are three things that we think about whenever we encounter Jewish communities. It's funny, they said, first of all, they circumcised their male children. That was really odd to the Romans. Second thing is they don't like pork. And the third thing is they won't fight on the Sabbath. They observe the Sabbath day where they just all rest, and they found that those were the three interesting markers as Romans looked at Jews. Anyway, a Sabbath is something which was a very characteristic festival. It begins Friday at sundown and Saturday at sundown. All festival markings begin at sundown. That's how they mark the beginning of new eras, new days. Anyway, the Sabbath experience, which is every 7 days, the Sabbath experience actually is a model which is then put on three annual festivals. And these festivals are Passover in the spring, and then about 7 weeks later, to Pentecost. Pentecost is in the book of Acts, but it's actually a Jewish festival. And then Tabernacles, which is in roughly October. So those are the three, and what they do is they follow the agricultural season in the Middle East. So Passover is actually the beginning of your cereal harvest. And then Pentecost is the end of the cereal harvest. Barley is mainly what they're marking. Barley was huge for bread making and, believe it or not, beer making. And then Tabernacles is the end of the harvest of tree and vine. So there are things like pomegranates and figs and grapes. They're all coming in October, olives as well. So what they would do is these are called pilgrimage festivals, and the expectation was as many people as possible would travel to Jerusalem, and you celebrated these in Jerusalem. You didn't celebrate these in your home or at the synagogue, but you went to Jerusalem, and that is where all celebrations of the festival would be organized around the temple. And there's where you would worship God and thank him for the harvest as it came in. So anyway, these festivals really become really important markers as Jews kind of live through their year. But not only did they think about, you know, the great agricultural events that were taking place and how thankful they were for the yield that was coming from the flocks and from the fields, but also they told a story about their own redemption inside of the festivals. So you've got three festivals here, and so therefore what story would you tell? Well, I can do it really easily. Number one, Passover, the first one, we escaped from Egypt. Okay, makes sense. What happened after they left Egypt? They went directly, secondly, to Mount Sinai, and at Sinai, they had a covenant established with God. So let's tell that story. So the second festival, you would tell actual stories about coming to Mount Sinai, coming through the desert. And then thirdly, we wandered in the desert for 38 years, 2 years back at Mount Sinai, and then 38 years in the desert. And therefore, the wilderness wanderings are all told in the third festival of Tabernacles. So there you have children, imagine this, Neil, growing up inside of first century Judaism, very much aware of what's happening agriculturally around them, thanking God for what is coming forth, and at each festival reciting the great events of Israel's salvation. So these festivals were not just parties. They were a way to sort of organize Jewish thinking about how God has really affected our lives. I think they were wonderful, and I wish that we as Christians had something that rich today.
Just, Gary, I'm curious, you talked about requirements. We'll touch on that a little bit, but were the stories added to the festivals, or were the festivals developed so that the stories could be told?
Well, the festivals are actually dictated right inside of the Jewish law, and so they really are part and parcel of the events that are taking place. So therefore, if you're reading about Passover and you discover that, okay, it's springtime, you have young lambs being born, therefore you are going to have an opportunity now to sacrifice to God right out of your yield of your flock. So the festivals actually are a response to what God is doing to bless you in your farm, your agriculture. That's what's happening. So they really run together, it wasn't necessarily sort of an addition that is placed on the season. But no, the law just actually has this. The idea is this, is that when God has given you rich blessings, such as a great barley yield one year, you should just stop everything and thank him for what you have just received. That's the idea.
And you did talk about the requirements, and I remember just kind of writing down a note as I was reading the book that, you know, the Jewish festivals seem so much more pointed with this expectation of reflection and action that, you know, we really don't have that so much here, or we've lost it if we did. So.
Yeah, we do not have a comprehensive cultural festival. The only thing that we have in the United States, Neil, is probably Christmas. You know, Christmas is the one which has been sort of taken up by secular culture, and it's celebrated just everywhere you go. And even every store you go into is going to have something about Christmas in it. That's as close as it comes for us, because we're a really diverse, multicultural world and country that we live in. To see this at work, you'd have to go to a Muslim country that would be celebrating, say, Ramadan, the month of fasting, which has just been completed. And in that Muslim country, everybody is Muslim for the most part, and everybody is celebrating something together. The last day of the festival, everybody sacrifices a sheep or a goat. So that's an experience that Americans just do not have. That's an experience that Israel had. So when there is that kind of comprehensive celebration, you'll find uniformity. So at Passover, yeah, you would have real expectations on how you sacrifice, how you eat that meal on the Passover night, what is in the meal. All of this is laid out for you in your religious literature. But here in America, I mean, I don't think anyone would ever imagine imposing a rule even on Christmas. I imagine, Neil, if you had an Easter egg hunt on Christmas, that would be problematic. Or if you decorated your Christmas tree in black and orange, it would be problematic because you'd say, wait a minute, those are Halloween colors. Sometimes these expectations are not written. Sometimes they're just cultural expectations, and sometimes they're very subtle. And what we do is we enjoy the subtlety of those expectations. One time I was in one of my classes, and I asked them, I said, okay, look, here's how subtlety works. You guys tell me, what is the most obscure and subtle image or code for Easter that you can imagine? And they came back to me, this was funny, they said, marshmallow peeps. And I went, what is a marshmallow peep? These are these little marshmallow candies that are shaped like little ducks, you know, and birds, and you can buy them at Easter time. And I said, well, what does that have to do with Easter? And the whole class said, we have no idea. We don't care. Well, we like marshmallow peeps. And they knew that marshmallow peeps are connected to Easter. So I think what happens is that cultures begin to accumulate codes and symbols inside of their festivals, and they delight in coming back to them, just like we delight in coming back to marshmallow peeps.
Yeah. Gary, we only have a couple minutes, 2 minutes literally, before we need to take an update break. But I'm wondering, and so I want to come back after the break and talk about some of the festivals kind of reveal you know, some of those. But I'm wondering, you know, the book of Hebrews talks about moving on from rituals and traditions of the past. And so is there value for us to study these, or have we just sort of moved on from that?
Well, actually, that is the last chapter of this book. In Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, I walk through how Jews were celebrating these things. And at the very end, I ask, okay, so what did Christians begin to think about this? And I think what you have is a really good answer in the New Testament for why Christians don't continue to celebrate Passover, or why we don't celebrate tabernacles, or why we don't go to a temple in Jerusalem. It's because Christ has fulfilled those things expected in these festivals. And maybe after the break, I can show how Jesus stepped into these festivals and actually takes advantage of some of their symbols. It's really fascinating.
Looking forward to hearing more from Professor Gary Burge, who serves as in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School, professor of New Testament there. He's written a number of works, and the one that we're talking about today is the volume 4 of a series called Ancient Context, Ancient Faith. They're just the short little volumes, but just packed and wonderful pictures from Zondervan. This is the one we're referencing today. It's called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals. And we're going to hear more in just a moment. I invite you to stay tuned. You want to join the conversation? We have some copies to give away. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. You're listening to Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Glad to have you listening today as we're connecting with Dr. Gary Burge, who is professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School. He's authored a number of books. The ones we're referencing today are part of his Ancient Context, Ancient Faith series. This is Volume 4 called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals. And we want to jump right in, Gary, to talk about some of those festivals. Talk about how Jesus used them to reveal himself. And I know you discussed whether it's water or a good shepherd or more. Let's just jump in.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe what I could do is move to one of the more obscure festivals, because that would be more fun, I think, for you.
Sure.
Most of us know about Passover because we celebrate some parts of Passover in when we do the Lord's Supper. But let me jump to the one in the October, because I think that's the more really quite fun. Tabernacles. A tabernacle is actually a temporary shelter, kind of like a tent. And you'll see Jewish communities today, when they celebrate tabernacles in October, they'll actually sleep outside, stay outside, look up into the sky, because they're remembering some things. Now, what happens in October is that you've come to the end of the festival season. Everything is in. I mean, the storehouse has got everything from barley to grains to figs to pomegranates. The whole deal is finished, and you're just waiting for the rains. Your work is done. It's time to have Thanksgiving. That's really what it is. So you come to Jerusalem, and you just have this amazing party is what you have. Now, two things, actually, they're thinking about when they get to Jerusalem. Not only do they want to praise God for the great yield of the year, but what they do is they're worried about drought. They're worried about rainfall in the Middle East every October. It has not rained probably since March in the Middle East, and therefore they are praying to God that there would actually be rainfall, because those early rains in November, December set up the soil for early planting. It's much earlier than we have in the Midwest. So that's the first thing that they're thinking about. Now, what's interesting is that it's a 7-day festival, and every day during the festival, to accompany their prayers, in case God has forgotten, it's kind of funny, what rain looks like, what they'll do is act out rain. They'll role play it. They'll go down to a spring in the south of Jerusalem, and they'll carry a pitcher of water up to the temple. They'll go to the temple, and then they'll pour it onto the altar of sacrifice, and then they will say, "Lord, that's rain." It's great. On the seventh day, they do this multiple times and say, really wash down the entire sacrificial area of the temple. Now, in John 7:37, Jesus is at Tabernacles. It says in chapter 7, he's at Tabernacles. On the great day when they're having the great water ceremony, this is when Jesus stands up in the temple and he says the following, "If any of you are thirsty..." Oh, now that's ironic. "If anybody is thirsty, come to me and drink, because out of his," Jesus, "belly will flow rivers of living water." Now, Jesus is actually doing this right in the middle of the water ceremony of Tabernacles, when everybody is worried about drought and they're hoping for rainfall, and he stands up and he says, "I'm the source of living water." It's great. That's the first thing that they're worried about, they're concerned about in October in the Middle East. The second thing they're thinking about is this. Every ancient culture in the Middle East marked the shortening, the lengthening of the night and the shortening of the days. And as we all know in the Northern Hemisphere, as we approach winter, days get shorter, nights get longer. And they knew that, too, in antiquity. So therefore, as they came to Tabernacles, they were aware that the days were, the light was getting less, and then they wanted to pray to God, please bring back the sunshine, bring back light, because light is what really gives us life. And our farms need light, of course, to grow. So on the great last day of the festival, they also had a light show inside of the temple. Most Christians don't know about this. It's written up in Jewish literature. What they would do is in the court of the women, they would have these huge bowls of oil, and they would put them up high. And then they would have a wick floating in the middle of the oil, and they would light the wick and create huge torches. Now, at night, cities in the ancient world were really dark. This was a light show that they put on, and all of the young men would dance under these blazing wicks. So anyway, it's at that moment when Jesus now steps forward, John chapter 8, and he says, I am the light of the world. Now, we've always taken that sentence and we've said, well, of course, he illumines our path, he's the light of God's revelation. No, it's more than that. Jesus is actually in the middle of a light show in Jerusalem at Tabernacles, and that's why he's making that announcement. So what Jesus does is he steps into these festivals and he exploits them. He takes one sort of piece of their code, one piece of their imagery, and he says, come to me because I am the source of that. Anyway, I could go through all the festivals and actually show you how he does this.
It's just as I've been reading, just fascinating that it was just sort of one after another. It seemed like that there was you know, whether it was, you know, light, water, what I mean, and so clearly those that were present would have fully understood. Right?
I mean, let's just come up with a really crazy analogy. It would be like someone stepping forward on December 24th, you know, that night, dressed in red and green with a very long silver beard, and making an announcement that he is the true Santa Claus. Everybody in America would know exactly what he was doing, you know, because they would look at his costume and they would look at his clothes and they'd say, he's wearing all of the codes of the festival. And everybody would know it. So when Jesus steps up in Tabernacles and he makes a pronouncement like that, yeah, it's you can't miss it. Well, he does the same thing, Neil, at a Passover John chapter 6. And, you know, at Passover, the meal actually has special unleavened bread you eat and a lamb is sacrificed. And this, in John 6:35, is where Jesus stands up and he says, I am the bread of life. And Passover is a festival which is all about the recollection of bread, the bread of their departure from Egypt. And Jesus now is talking about the bread of life. And remember, right after that, they go into the wilderness, and God gives them bread, manna, which falls from heaven. They're actually thinking about manna bread during the Passover celebration as well. So in John 6, Jesus says, I'm the bread of life. And the crowd immediately knows what he's talking about. And the crowd says, are you actually fulfilling what Moses gave to us, the manna in the wilderness? Neil, no doubt about it. Jesus' audience has always understood this kind of stuff. But we are foreigners. We're outsiders. And this book kind of becomes a guidebook. It becomes a tour book so that Westerners like us can time travel and see things they've never seen before.
It's interesting because I know in John chapter 10, and you discuss this as well, and Jesus talks about being the good shepherd, and you know, that was clearly understood as well. And by this time, of course, the religious leaders were getting a little upset, right? I mean, just a side question, did John particularly write putting these little facts in? It was during Tabernacles, so that the reader of his day would understand it, or is it more just that we overlook it as we read through the text?
Well, we do overlook a lot of it, which is unfortunate, but John is a great gospel writer, and that's my other interest. I've, you know, worked a lot in the Gospel of John. One of the things that John does that Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't tend to do as much is that John knows that his readers do not get a lot of this stuff, and therefore he writes as a coach. And consequently, when one of these things takes place, he gives little explanations about why it's taking place or why the Jews are doing this and not doing that. And so John is, the gospel writers know that these are stories from Jesus which are very locked in to the Jewish culture of the first century. And they know that this story has got to go to the Greek world and the Roman world, and therefore they have to help their readers understand it. So, yeah, the gospel writers, yeah, they give us tips. Again and again, John gives us a lot of tips. But today, 2,000 years later, we need more tips.
We're talking today with Gary Burge, who has written Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, one of his latest. It's part of the Ancient Context, Ancient Faith series. There are four volumes in this series. And I'm interested, Gary, that it seems like, you know, Jesus was much more, I guess, provocative as I've, you know, looked through your book and then looking through the Gospels again, that, you know, when he stood up in the midst of festivals and made these pronouncements, I mean,
right.
he was asking for trouble in some ways, wasn't he?
Well, in some sense, yeah. I mean, asking for trouble, yeah, being provocative. I think it would be better to think that Jesus was theatrical. Jesus was dramatic. And Jesus came from a culture which was theatrical and dramatic. We come from a culture that enjoys subtlety. We enjoy we like reserve. When was the last time that we were all in church and we heard a great deal of shouting and hand clapping? I mean, you just don't. We tend to be a bit more restrained culturally. Jesus' world is a world of expression and drama. If you're going to be a great teacher, you're going to have to do things that are dramatic. That's still the Middle Eastern culture even today. So, yeah, and Jesus in his own time and place, was making a stir. He was making a stir. But a great teacher has to make a stir. Anil, here's a great little proverb that comes out of this period. And it's a great proverb. I think every pastor probably ought to have it pinned to a bulletin board somewhere. The rabbis would say, a great teacher never serves his students a basket of cucumbers. You know, if you've ever tried to eat a whole cucumber, imagine eating a whole basket. It's like sitting in a lecture in which you are getting stuffed with things which really make you uncomfortable. Here's what it says. A great teacher never serves his students a basket of cucumbers. A great teacher always puts a peppercorn under the tongue. So in other words, a great teacher is somebody who provokes the student so that they are digesting something that's in their mouth now, which really makes them think. And of course, the peppercorn under your tongue, you're not going to forget that experience for a while.
Good insight. We're going to spend a little time talking. We were talking about Jesus and the Jewish festivals. Mentioned a couple that we may not be familiar with. We are familiar with Passover, and there's some things that we want to talk about that and give Gary an opportunity to sort of paint a picture for us of Passover week in Jerusalem. We'll do that in just a moment. We're getting some great teaching today from Gary Burge, who is a professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School. And the book we're referencing is called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals. It's from an Ancient Context, Ancient Faith series, and it's volume 4. He also talks about the Bible and the land, Jesus the Middle Eastern storyteller, and encounters with Jesus. And we'll have some more encounters with Professor Gary Burge in just a moment. Stay tuned. Six past the hour. It's Connecting Faith. Today we're connecting with Gary Burge, professor at Wheaton College and Graduate School. He's written a number of works on ancient culture, and this is the book we're talking about. It's called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, and it's just a short little book, 130 or so pages, and got beautiful pictures in it. Gary, it's really a well-done resource, and I'm sure it'll be very helpful for people that want to just understand a little bit more. Written in very readable, practical language. So, you know, we all are familiar in some ways with Passover, but as you described it, it was sort of hard to imagine what it would be like in Jerusalem to add 100,000 people during that season. So just kind of paint a picture for us of Passover and then how Jesus was able to get his message across.
Right. Passover is, of course, of the three festivals, the three pilgrimage festivals, it's the most important. It launches the Jewish year. It tells about the great story of the Israelite departure from Egypt with Moses' leadership. And with every festival in every culture, they're dynamic, and they grow, and they evolve, and they become more complicated with every generation. It's just the same if you were to go back 200 years and look at how Americans celebrated Christmas. We do it very differently than we did it even 50, 60 years ago. So the Jewish Passover festival actually went through a lot of change and a lot of evolution from Old Testament times right up until the time of Jesus. So in Jesus' day, as many people as could would pilgrimage with their families to Jerusalem. You wouldn't empty your village because, of course, the problems with theft and everything would be huge. So the families would come to Jerusalem, and they would camp around the city of Jerusalem. So you can imagine, the city of Jerusalem, we think, was maybe about 30,000 population normally. But we think the population even tripled during this time. So it was quite an economic boom for the city. And there was a sense of coming together as a nation. Imagine children, you know, walking 100 miles, it would be 100 miles from, say, Nazareth to Jerusalem, walking all of that way and then joining with, you know, tens of thousands of people for 7 days, telling stories, singing songs, you know, bringing goods for trade. It was quite a thing. What would happen is that on the day of preparation, before the sundown, when Passover would actually begin, you would be required to sacrifice an animal. And it would have to be a one-year-old lamb, or most people don't know this, you could actually replace that with a goat if you wanted to. Here's a funny little aside. When I'm in the Middle East, I love lamb, and I often ask for it. On the other hand, sometimes I'm served goat, and the restaurant just thinks, well, lamb, goat, what's the difference? There is a difference. So they're really similar, at least in terms of ritual. You would sacrifice the lamb at the temple, and then what would happen is that you would the Levites would take the lamb, put it up on a meat hook after it's been killed, some of its blood from its neck. That's where they cut the neck of the animal. If you're not squeamish, I actually have that fully described and photographed inside of the chapter of this book. Then some of the blood would be poured at the altar, and then the fleece would be pulled off of the lamb, the sort of the woolly part, and then they would open it and take out all of the inner organs, and these would stay behind for the priests. They were considered delicacies. Then you would take that carcass with you and carry it to a location inside the city walls where families would come together, so you had maybe 30 or so people. It would be roasted. It had to be roasted, by the way, on a wood skewer. I have no reason why. It couldn't be metal. It has to be wood. And then you would consume the lamb as a part of a ritual meal, and all of the elements of the meal actually had symbolic meaning. Okay? Now, today, when you go to a Jewish family and they actually have a Passover meal, Judaism has continued to expand and change a lot of the festival elements. And so today what you'll have in a Jewish Seder service is not necessarily what they did in the first century, but that's to be expected because these things are dynamic. But here's the part that I think is really fascinating. Because Judaism understood that when you sacrifice, you're actually creating a kind of meal with God. The meat is being sacrificed. Some of it is burned on the altar. God is participating with you, you might say, at a meal. That's how they viewed it. So when you're having the Passover meal, those who did not go to the temple that day and actually sacrifice the lamb, they may have asked the question, how do we join with this lamb in having benefits from its death? In other words, we too want to benefit from this lamb's sacrifice. How can we do that? And the answer that was given is this. Those who consume the meat of the sacrificial victim, when you eat a portion of that lamb, you are joining with that lamb's death. That's a very important idea because not everyone went to the temple that day to sacrifice. So when you consume a part of the sacrificial victim, you then join with that victim in its death. Now, when Jesus is in the upper room, This is a gigantic idea, Neil. Jesus then says, when I go to the cross on this Passover, that cross will be, as it were, my altar of sacrifice. And then he takes bread, he breaks it, and he says, this is my body, and he distributes it to them all. And he says, we'll paraphrase, when you consume this bread, you are actually participating with me in my altar. That's what he's saying. So therefore, Jesus is taking advantage of ideas that were richly embedded in the Jewish Passover. And he's teaching that if you want to be a participant in my cross, when you eat this bread, you will join me. Just like in eating the lamb of the Passover, you join in its death at the temple. So anyway, I lay all this out, and when you read this, you suddenly recognize, oh my goodness, when Jesus was establishing the Lord's Supper at Passover, he was doing things which all 12 of his Jewish followers understood instinctively. The problem is, we don't understand them anymore.
You know, that's maybe we can bring to a close here as our time goes by to be able to understand instinctively. I mean, as we read the scriptures, short of spending years in the Middle East and delving into culture, and these, of course, your little books will be of great help. But is there a way that we can maybe see with new eyes as we read to have maybe that instinctive understanding?
Yeah, I think so. I wish that. I mean, every Christian audience that I'm in before, I wish that we would all carry with us a really contemporary translation of our New Testament. That really helps, because enormous scholarship goes into making these translations. I'm on one translation committee. I know how hard that work is. Second thing is, if you can afford it, have a good study Bible that has footnotes at the bottom of the page, so that every time you come across sort of something you may not understand, there's a cultural explanation. And then thirdly, if you really want to delve in deeply, try to begin collecting a library. Begin putting together books that speak to certain portions of Scripture that have always been deeply meaningful for you in your life. And if Christians just took those steps of acquiring added learning, their experience with the Bible would be completely different.
Let's just kind of circle back to, as you're talking about the last chapter of the book, the early Christians, how they determined
right.
which festivals to maintain, which ones to pass away, and I guess maybe for us as well, should we be engaging in seders, those kinds of things?
Right. I think Christians have had great experiences, especially when they join with a Jewish synagogue and celebrate their Passover. But I think as Christians, what Christians have said from the very beginning, they've said, well, wait, we're not Jews. We actually are Christians, and therefore whatever we do needs to celebrate Christ. So therefore, I think what we want to say is we would only want to do to recreate a Passover if we included in that Passover a recognition of what Jesus did at his Passover. So likewise, when it came to Sabbath observance, early Christians said, well, okay, we do want a day of rest. We want it to be on a seven-day cycle. But for us, the great event is the resurrection of Jesus, and therefore worship moves from Saturday to Sunday. So very early on, Christians had to rethink the place of the temple, the place, believe it or not, even of the Holy Land, the place of Passover, tabernacles, and so forth. They wanted to rethink those and ask, how does Jesus make a difference? By the way, following on from this book, the book I wrote right after this is called Jesus and the Land. And there actually, in that book, I show Christians even had to rethink their relationship to the Holy Land, just like they rethought their relationship to the temple. They wanted to be distinctively Christian. They wanted to be distinctively Christ followers in all that they did, and that included their festivals.
Gary, we'd love to have you back sometime and talk a little more. We had a little kind of phone challenges this time, but it was great material. I'm thinking we probably would do well to get into that Sabbath cycle ourselves in terms of just resting, that would be a good place to start in our deeper understanding.
We could learn from our Jewish neighbors. I once lived for 5 years in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in Chicago, and I learned so much from them. And I really learned how we really don't know what to do with our festival Sunday. We don't. I mean, it's church until noon, lunch and shopping for many of us. And our Jewish neighbors could teach us a great deal.
Well, Gary, you've taught us a lot, and we look forward to hearing more and reading more from your works. Gary Burge is a professor of New Testament in the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies at Wheaton College and Graduate School, has authored a number of books. The one we referenced today is called Jesus and the Jewish Festivals, published by Zondervan. I encourage recommend it to you. It's a great little resource. Gary, thanks so much. Have a great year at school. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and I want to encourage you to join us tomorrow. We're going to talk about something very current, particularly in this contested presidential election year. We'll talk about politics according to the Bible. And we welcome back to Connecting Faith Dr. Wayne Grudem, who will join us. He's written a great work on politics according to the Bible. That's the topic tomorrow. By the way, join Susie Larson this afternoon. She talks with Kim Cattola about her new book and a new radio program coming to Facebook.